ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Thursday, the 30th of October. I'm Sabra Lane coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. US President Donald Trump's praised Prime Minister Anthony Albanese during a dinner in South Korea with other world leaders ahead of another summit, saying he's done a fantastic job on the $13 billion critical minerals deal they struck last week.
We had a great meeting a week ago. You came all the way and now you came here, but this isn't quite as far. This time I traveled far. But you've done a fantastic job. But we're working together on rare earths, but we're working on a lot of things together, and it's all working out very well.
South Korea is holding this year's APEC meeting of Asia-Pacific leaders. It's also hosting one of the most anticipated meetings this year. Between Mr. Trump and the Chinese President Xi Jinping, the two nations have been engaged in a trade war, but the US President's flagging the two could make a good deal. North Asia correspondent James Oten reports from the South Korean city of Gwangju.
The US President Donald Trump received another red carpet welcome as his tour of Asia draws to a close. While meetings with the South Korean president and a dinner in his honour were the first order of business, Donald Trump's upcoming one-on-one with China's president Xi Jinping is stealing all the attention.
And I think we're going to have a great meeting with President Xi of China, and a lot of problems are going to be solved.
Good?
Yeah, I'm very optimistic. I am.
Donald Trump has relished in new trade deals after announcing sweeping tariffs earlier this year. But China has proven to be a formidable foe, retaliating with its own tariffs. It stopped buying soybeans from the US and then announced restrictions on rare earths. China's the dominant player in that space, controlling around 90% of production. Professor Wu Jinbo is from the Center for American Studies at Fudan University in Shanghai.
It's not just a tactical bargaining chip. I think for China, it's a national security issue and it's a strategic leverage in dealing with the US.
He says China has taken this step partially in response to the restrictions the US imposed on advanced microchips.
This kind of a securitization of resources or market or technology is something we learned from the US since the first Trump administration. You know, in the past, this has never been a problem. But now we gradually realize that maybe this is a necessary leverage we should play vis-a-vis the US.
The US president is renowned for his transactional approach to international diplomacy, seeking to strike deals while being less concerned about the broader geopolitical play. He's already flagged granting China access to advanced NVIDIA microchips.
I don't think that Donald Trump himself is all that really focused on strategic competition with China, but I think the rest of the US government and the US system is sort of locked into strategic competition.
That's Jared Monshine. He's the director of research at the United States Study Center at the University of Sydney.
There is concern that Donald Trump perhaps may deliver more to China than what many in the United States strategic community would want him to offer. But it's hard to imagine the U.S. Going back to U.S.-China relations in the 2010 era and before. Can't see any sort of agreement with China lasting very long, because all recent agreements have not lasted very long with China.
This is James Oten in Gwangju, reporting for AM.
The Tomago Aluminium Plant, New South Wales, makes about 37% of Australia's aluminium and it's power hungry, using 10% of the state's electricity. Yet it could close because Rio Tinto, a part owner of the plant, says it can't secure affordable power from 2028 when its current contract expires. And that means it's a political hot potato, with critics lining up to suggest policies to achieve net zero carbon emissions by 2050 are to blame. The federal government says all options are on the table as the company talks with workers about the plant's potential closure. I spoke with the federal industry minister earlier. Tim Ayres, thanks for joining AM.
Hey, it's really good to be on the show, Sabra.
The federal government says no options off the table. Does that include potentially taking a public stake in Tomago to keep it open or even subsidising its power bills?
Well, we mean what we say. No option is off the table. We will keep engaging with the company and with the New South Wales government, with the trade unions who are engaged in all of this work. That's what people would expect. I won't, on your show or any other show, go into the details of those discussions, not because I'm trying to be evasive, Sabra, but because they are, confidential discussions calculated to try and secure a good result for the region and for Australia.
The federal government announced a $2 billion Green Metal Fund deal before the federal election this year, partly aimed at helping this plant stay open with a tax credit for aluminium and steel produced with renewable energy. The Rio chief at the time claimed credit, saying it meant finding a future for this plant. My colleague David Spears has written about this today. What has happened to that optimism? Within 9 months, the company's gone from saying this plant has a good future to we're closing it down.
This production credit is, of course, designed to secure the future of aluminium in Australia. It's achieved that or will achieve that objective, in my view, much more optimistic about the future of the Boyne Island smelter in central Queensland, where Rio has been out underwriting wind and solar projects around Queensland, investing in the future of that facility. We've got more work to do in New South Wales.
But what has happened here? The chief said Tamargo had a future earlier this year, and now they say it doesn't. What's happened? Do you wonder?
Yeah, obviously would prefer that these issues had been resolved with the Tomago smelter. They are facing a bridge of 4 or 5 years between now and securing future investment in wind and solar and transmission in New South Wales. That is a long period. The discussions have been focused on what happens over the course of that 4 years. And I just say, we need, industrial Australia needs more electricity, more transmission. And if I can just make the partisan observation for a second, Sabra, having elements of the National Party careering around the country, campaigning against wind and solar and transmission is harming blue-collar jobs because blue-collar jobs and industry in the regions need access to cheap renewable power. That's what those companies are demanding, not because they are hippies, but because that's what their markets are demanding.
The Boyne plant in Queensland is being subsidised. The power bills are being subsidised by Queensland. Is that what you're suggesting here, that New South Wales should stump up and subsidise part of the bills for Tamargo?
Well, I just say, I've been around manufacturing for a long time, Sabra, and you can see it when there's investment going on over the years leading up to a decision like this. When you see investment in new plant and equipment, planned investment coming, investment and underwriting energy projects like the wind and solar projects that Rio is investing in Queensland, and of course in New South Wales. That activity has not been happening in the same way around that plant. So, of course, I'm concerned about what that means about the future of the plant. People in the Hunter Valley, workers who work there, are concerned about that.
Your colleague
say that every day.
Your colleague, Ed Husic, the former industry minister, is no Rio fan. He says it's gone from blowing up Aboriginal heritage on the west coast to undermining smelters on the east coast. He says it's corporate villainy. He's not alone in those sentiments, and he's your predecessor.
Well, my job here is to work in a careful and calculated way that is about the Australian national interest. We've done that work in a series of smelters around the country in a careful way in the public interest, locking in investment in places like Port Pirie and Hobart, where you're broadcasting from today, in Mount Isa. We are, as a government, working through these questions, engaging in Boyne Island, challenges in northern Tasmania. We will keep focused on these issues because, yes, it's about jobs in the regions, but we're also focused here on making sure that we're protecting Australia's economic resilience and our national interest. The Tomago smelter is one of a series of Australian aluminium smelters. I want them all to proceed, but we're going to work on this one carefully in the national interest.
Tim Ayres, thanks for talking to AM.
Thanks, Sabra.
The aged care system changes this weekend, and advocates are warning older Australians accessing government-funded help at home risk having to cut back on their services because of rising fees. Political reporter Evelyn Manfield reports.
Major changes to the way people pay for aged care are just days away, and older Australians are finding out the new costs for support at home like cleaning, gardening and showering. Chief Executive of the Older Persons Advocacy Network, Craig Gear, is keeping a close eye.
We want to see that older people are still getting the same level of service that they were receiving.
People who were already on or had been approved for a home care package when the changes passed Parliament last year were given a no-worse-off guarantee that they won't have to make a greater contribution to their care.
But because of some of the price increases that have come through from providers, it may mean that their purchasing power from their package is less than what they had before.
Everyone's package is different, and an example calculation from the government shows because of a reduction in management fees, this example recipient would have 27% more money to cover a higher per hour price. But Craig Gear says there are conflicting stories.
We have heard from some older people that there's price changes from between 30 and 40% increases in the per hour rates, but there has been also a reduction in the administration fees that are charged and the care management fees. So it's hard to tell whether this is swings and roundabouts or whether they're being significant price increases, but we are expecting that most people are going to see some form of increase in the charges.
Linda Henderson is one of around 300,000 Australians currently getting a home care package. She reckons the overall cost of her cleaning and gardening services are set to rise by 10%.
Which would mean that where I'm paying, say, $50 for my support worker, $55 will come out of my package. So for me and for many other people, that means a reduction in hours. I have a permanent spinal disability. There are lots of things that I can't do in this house. And to lose those hours of support is going to be a real worry.
Recipient Hannah Law doesn't think she'll be better off either.
We've been told all along that we're under this no worse off principle, but we can't see that that's going to be the case. We will be worse off because we will lose services.
Federal MP for Mayo, Rebecca Sharkey, says the full impact of the changes aren't yet clear, but her constituents are worried and confused, including people entering the system who'll be paying bigger co-contributions for non-clinical care.
I'm yet to hear from a constituent who thinks that they're going to be better off under this new system. It really is a bit of a nightmare, and I try not to catastrophise it, but my goodness.
Craig Gear from the Older Persons Advocacy Network says anyone facing a reduction in care hours should talk to their provider or seek a reassessment.
Evelyn Manfield there, and a spokesperson for SAMRE, the Federal Aged Care Minister, says the reforms will deliver a more transparent pricing model by capping care management fees. More than 30 years after being dry, Wadeye, one of the Northern Territory's largest remote communities, is on the brink of a return to licensed alcohol. Traditional owners say the new social club will be a place for people to enjoy drinking in moderation, but critics say the stakes are high. James Elton travelled to Wadeye for the story.
Builders are putting the finishing touches on Wadeye's new social club.
Brand new cool room. All the drinks and stuff will be.
Residents in this large remote community on the west coast of the Top End, about 5 hours from Darwin, may soon be able to do something they haven't done for 30 years, meet up for a beer at a local licensed venue. It's something Cardew Dimon and traditional owner Margaret Purgett has wanted for a long time.
It's really important for me to have a club out here on my land so people can come have a quiet drink.
Miss Purgett is the chair of the club's managing corporation. She herself is a non-drinker, but she believes the club has the potential to reduce drink driving and the pull of alcohol leading to people sleeping rough in urban centres like Darwin.
Going into town, spending a lot of money, staying in long grass with no home.
Wadeye has struggled with violence and community unrest, along with a trade in black market alcohol, often called grog running. In a notice approving the new club's licence last year, the NT Liquor Commission said there was, quote, a reasonable prospect that the club will disrupt the business model of grog runners and attract members who elect to spend $50 on six mid-strength beers instead of $500 on a bottle of rum in the bush. But it does not disregard the real possibility that the club will fail to reduce alcohol-related harm. Dr. Peter Dabbs is an honorary fellow at the Menzies School of Public Health.
The challenges are real, but yes, I think it can work.
Dr. Dabbs has worked on alcohol policy in the NT for decades.
A club requires strong local management, and that means, you know, having a reasonably strong cohesive board. It means having a good manager, and it means having good staff. And none of those things are easy.
What Is Last Social Club came to a dramatic end. In 1988, a group of strident Aboriginal non-drinkers, tired of alcohol-fuelled violence, took matters into their own hands.
A group of 50 non-drinkers attacked the town's only licensed premises.
Two men went to court over the club's destruction, but the magistrate let them go, saying they acted to save the people from destroying themselves. William Palmbok was one of them. He has no regrets, but says he won't be smashing the new club.
I do worry. There are non-drinkers in the community, especially women, that don't like drunken husband coming home and doing violence at home. But I'm against it, and I know some other people are too.
Wadaya resident William Palmbok ending James Elton's report. A Queensland academic says the miscommunication behind the ancient history exam bungle could happen again. More than 140 Year 12 students studying ancient history across at least 9 high schools prepared for an exam on Augustus instead of Julius Caesar. The Queensland Education Minister says an investigation's underway, but some experts say failures right across the system are the cause. Elizabeth Cramsey reports.
Student teacher Isaac Joyce was on a university placement in a high school ancient history class earlier this year when he noticed something odd.
They were teaching instead about the Augustan reforms and the things he did once he became Caesar, which is disconnected from Julius Caesar, which is a bit of a major issue.
Queensland's education department has confirmed at least 9 schools have taught Year 12 students the wrong topic for their end-of-year history exam. Among them is Redcliffe High, just north of Brisbane, where Isaac Joyce saw students working on essays and reports using the old source material.
I think for the schools it could just come down to either a technical issue, human error, just missing email or something.
Isaac Joyce is in his final year of a teaching degree at the University of Queensland, where he says they are constantly reminded to double-check the syllabus.
In pretty much every tutorial I had, it was hammered into my head again. The syllabus has changed. Make sure you're using the right one for the right class.
The Education Minister, John Paul Langbrook, has ordered an investigation into the Queensland Curriculum and Assessment Authority, which sets the topics for Year 12 exams. He wants to see details about the processes which were followed when the curriculum was changed and how those changes were communicated to schools. The Assessment Authority declined an interview, but Acting Chief Executive Officer Claude Jones released a statement with an excerpt read here by an actor.
As a first step, exam topics will be made more prominent on websites and online portals.
Curriculum and pedagogy expert at the University of Southern Queensland, Dr. Alison Bedford, says there are important questions to be answered.
There have been multiple points of failure, and it's so important that we don't allow this pile onto the teacher in the classroom. The question really is, how has our education system failed those teachers to let this happen? Where was their support from their head of department, their colleagues, their school leadership? Why weren't they fully engaged with their professional communities and networks so they had that peer and collegial support?
She says some of the memos about the change of content from the Assessment Authority were sent at a similar time to Cyclone Alfred, which impacted southeast Queensland, where the affected schools are located.
Perhaps there was a missed opportunity there for the QCAA to say, hey, you might have missed this because your house was underwater. Just letting you know that we're doing Julius Caesar.
And Dr. Bedford isn't confident it's the last time such an error could happen.
That story by Elizabeth Cramsey and Joanna Carruthers. That is AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast.
Kamala Harris is back on your screens. Yes, she's spruiking a memoir, but she's also testing the waters to see if she could run again for the US presidency. Today, 7:30 host Sarah Ferguson on her Australian exclusive interview with the former vice president. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.